on the other side of the runway, just 300 meters or so from him. He also knew that if he left Khan and Mufti behind, he'd be hunted down and killed by the KRF as punishment. So he lay there, waiting for the fighting to stop, waiting for his people to finish off the Americans. In the meantime, he held a pistol in his hand and prayed he wouldn't get caught in the crossfire. Back inside the bunker, Khan ran over to Mufti, who had just climbed down from the side of the first helicopter where he'd been conferring with the pilot through the window.
"How much more time do you need?" Khan demanded. "The aircraft have enough fuel to get to their destinations. What's the situation outside?"
"We are holding them back from overrunning the bunker, but we won't defeat them. They sent a company or more, probably Special Forces, SEALs, or Delta,"
Mufti said.
"From Salerno."
Khan nodded. Mufti seemed to think a moment. He looked like he wasn't sure what to do. Khan said,
"We have 25 men still in reserve here in the bunker. When we open the blast doors, they will suppress the attack. The pilots will have to taxi out of the bunker under fire and then take off quickly."
Mufti looked up at the ceiling, then at the blast doors in front of him.
"My pilots aren't taxiing anywhere. Rolling takes too long. They're going to fly out of here. It's the only way to get out of the line of fire from those machine guns."
Khan himself looked up at the ceiling and at the doors.
"Your men, they can do this?"
Major Omar Mufti looked at the four spinning helicopters, one in front of the other. It seemed like he was evaluating the pilots one by one.
"The first three pilots have the skill, but the fourth aircraft..."
He just shook his head.
"He's just too inexperienced,"
Khan said.
"Put one of the co-pilots from another flight into that seat. We have to try to get them all out of here."
Mufti pulled his shoulders back and stood tall.
"No. The last helo will be the hardest to pilot. The Americans will be ready since three helicopters will have already performed the same maneuver. There is only one pilot here with the skill to fly that mission."
"Who?"
"Me."
Khan looked at his second-in-command in astonishment.
"Where will you fly it?"
Mufti was absolutely resolute now.
"You will come with me. There is no way you can get out of here in the army chopper outside in the middle of the firefight. We will escape from the base in the last BV-107. I will take you north, some kilometers away, land and let you out, and then I will continue on to FOB Salerno."
With pride in his voice, he said,
"I will detonate the conventional explosives right over the operations center of the base and kill all the leadership commanding the Americans' attack."
Khan looked around the bunker. From the sound of the intense battle outside, there was no other way out of here.
"You will protect me to fight another day, and you will martyr yourself."
Khan said it with reverence.
"It will be my honor to do both, sir."
The two men began running for the rear helicopter. On the way there, Khan passed Nasser Rasool. The young technical specialist had put up his walkie-talkie, and now he held an AK in his hand as he moved towards the blast doors. Khan lurched to a stop.
"Nasser, what are you doing?"
The young man looked resolute.
"I'm going to fight the Americans. The helicopters must make it to their targets."
Khan grabbed him by the arm.
"You are too important, brother."
Khan told him what he wanted him to do, and then Rasool lowered the rifle and lifted his radio again. Into it he said,
"Cut all lights! All Mujahideen to the blast doors! Open them and go fight the Americans! God willing, we will be victorious!"
A moment later, the entire bunker went dark.
"Follow me,"
Khan said, and then he and Rasool ran to the rear of the last Boeing Vertel and leapt up onto the rear hatch. Mufti himself was already climbing into the co-pilot seat in the cockpit, explaining to the young pilot there that he was now the co-pilot, and Mufti himself would fly the helicopter out of the tight bunker and through the gunfire. The young man was visibly relieved. Khan made it up to the cockpit, and he looked through the windscreen as men ran past on both sides through the darkness, Kalashnikovs, RPGs, and PKMs at their shoulders, desperate to buy time for the four Trojan horses. Hightower and the rest of Gulf Sierra moved quickly but carefully through the darkness, south across a parade ground on Ismail Zai base and towards the cacophony of gunfire on the far side of the large metal warehouse building. They could see flashes in the sky beyond, and Court thought he could also hear the thump-thump of a single rotored helicopter in the brief spaces when the clack-clack-clack of gunfire waned for a moment. Hightower was desperately trying to raise the chief petty officer leading the SEAL team engaging the KRF on the south side of the bunker.
"Gulf Sierra Actual for Dodger Actual, come in!"
He'd called over the radio multiple times as he'd advanced, before a man with a southern accent finally responded.
Dodger 08 for inbound traffic. Repeat your last. Dodger 08, this is Golf Sierra Actual. How copy?
I copy. Good to hear from you boys.
Where's your actual, over?
He's WIA, being treated at this time. We've got one KIA and two more WIA. We're engaging hostiles from the aircraft hangar with the Ranger element.
Copy all. We're heading to you. Six operators.
What's your ETA on our pause, over?
We'll bypass the warehouse and approach on the northwest side of the HAZ. Swing around and engage from the west. How copy?
Solid copy. Be advised. We estimate 50-plus enemy. PKMs, RPGs, and battle rifles. Some are dug in. Some have hasty fighting positions. But they sure as hell are protecting that bunker. Lots of burning tires over here. Viz is bad and NODs are useless. Also be advised, there's a Huey spinning at idle on the tarmac just west of the entrance to the HAZ. Appears to be unoccupied.
Zack was about to confirm receipt of this information, but Dodger 08 spoke again.
Wait one!
Court heard a shuffling through his headset, then the SEAL's voice as he spoke to the others around him.
Blast doors are opening! Blast doors opening!
Court was in tune with Hightower now. He knew it was his job to pick up the speed of the stack as they progressed through the dark. He broke into a full run now, still sweeping his weapon left and right as the other five men stayed with him, and they ran along the side of the metal warehouse and came out just 100 yards or so from the side of the bunker where all the fighting was taking place. The SEAL enlisted man came back over the radio.
More enemy coming out of the bunker! It's dark in there, but I can make out a large vehicle inside. Could be a tractor trailer!
Court heard a voice near the SEAL doing the talking.
You hear that shit? Those are rotors! Fucking rotors!
Fuck me,
the radio man mumbled, and then,
Dodger 08 to Golf Sierra Actual. We've got a twin rotor helicopter flying out of the bunker at this time. It appears, what the fuck?
Court could hear Zack's voice, labored from the sprint, straining to get information out of the SEAL.
What do you see, Dodger? It's a Chesapeake. What the fuck's he doing in Pakistan?
The man from SEAL Team 10 didn't get it, but Zack understood. He transmitted,
Trojan horses! That's how they're delivering the dirty bombs into Afghanistan! Say again, Sierra Actual?
Hightower barked into his radio.
Listen up, Dodger 08! That is a hostile aircraft!
The SEAL enlisted man said.
We're clear to fire on the helicopter? Affirmative, Dodger!
The young man remained unsure, even in the middle of all the combat.
Say again, Sierra 1. You are confirming the red and white Chesapeake helicopters as hostile. That one is, goddammit! Let that motherfucker up!
60. Present day. Priyanka Bhandari had been alternating the image on her monitor between a pair of camera views, the two men standing around the hallway on the 25th floor of this building, and the view of the entrance to the building under construction next door. She had neglected to check the other cameras for the past several minutes, so she flipped from the construction site view to the 25th floor view, and she was startled to see the elevator door open. Three men stepped out. She saw only their backs now, and she chastised herself for not noticing them when they were on another floor, or being aware if they came in through the lobby. Looking them over as they passed down the hall, she decided two of them were Indian, one big and burly, and the other shorter but no less burly. The third man, however, was slight. He wore a tan raincoat, he had disheveled graying hair, and his hands seemed to be secured behind his back. Her heart sank when she realized she was looking at Ted Appleton. Appleton was escorted past the guards, then the door to the penthouse was opened, and he was led inside by a third man. There could be no doubt now. B Company and the Pakistanis were here in Tower 1. This to her meant Khan was here as well. And now he had Appleton. The Indians on 25 headed back towards the elevator, and the door to the penthouse slammed shut. Priya tried in vain to raise Cobalt on the phone, but he did not answer. She took a moment to slow her breathing, and while she did so, she also did her best to process the situation before her. She had told Ted that Cobalt was on his way over to Tower 2. She knew how easily Khan had extracted information from her. Appleton would be better. It might take some time for him to tell all he knew, like Priya had done without receiving so much as a scratch, but still, he would talk, and Cobalt would be in danger. She sat there, looking at her computer monitor in the darkened office, and she realized she couldn't be sure if Appleton had had the time to alert the authorities before he was taken. Quickly, she picked up the phone on the desk. The elevator door dinged and then opened on the other side of the office behind her. and she spun around towards the sound. Men filed out. They were still some distance from her, so she turned to dial 100 on the phone, the Mumbai police emergency number. But before she could do this, she heard the sound of a stairwell door opening on her left, just feet away. She punched the three numbers, then crouched down under the desk to hide while she made the call. The phone rang, rang again, and then it stopped ringing. A voice just on the other side of the workstation, near the window, said,
"You won't be contacting the police, Miss Bandari."
She reached into her pants pocket for her phone, then realized it was up on the desk above her.
"Come out, please."
She did so, and stood up to find five men, four with squat submachine guns and one standing closer, his fingers still on the telephone desk unit, pressing down on the disconnect button. The men with guns kept them up and sweeping back and forth around the large room. Two more men, the ones who came out of the elevator, had done a sweep of the space, and they approached with heads shaking. She realized they were searching for others here with her. Looking back at the man who'd hung up the phone, she realized she knew him. She had seen him 2 days earlier in Andheri East. He'd stood out at the time because he was the man in the room who refused to watch when Murad Khan was about to torture her. He smiled at her now and spoke in Hindi with a Pakistani accent.
"I ran a check of the building security system, and I could see that this terminal on this floor was watching the camera feed of the hall on the penthouse level. From there, it was easy to deduce you were in the building."
He looked around now. "Where is your friend?"
"My friend?"
"The American assassin you work for."
Priya said nothing. He forced her to unlock her phone, and he scrolled through her calls quickly, trying to ascertain if she had contacted the police, R&AW, the CIA, or any other entity. Satisfied she had not, he nodded, then spoke in Urdu to the others.
"Take her upstairs. Stay vigilant. The killer is somewhere close."
In the penthouse on the 25th floor, Murad Khan stood in a study in front of a floor-to-ceiling window that gave a perfect view to the construction site next door. Although it was dark as dusk outside now at 4:30 p.m., he faced the glass, his telephone to his ear. Former CIA station chief Ted Appleton was brought into the room behind him, then shoved down onto a chair to wait. After several seconds, Khan spoke into his phone.
"Hassan."
It was Arabic, and Appleton knew it meant good. He put his phone back in his pocket, then sat down on the sofa, eyeing the American with derision, while three other armed security men stood close.
"We meet at last,"
the Pakistani said, but Appleton did not immediately reply. The American was too busy looking into the eyes of the man who had ripped his heart out so many years ago. He wasn't afraid. He wasn't even angry. He just felt an unceasing weight of failure, of being bested by the man in front of him. Not once, but twice. Finally, after mustering up the energy to speak, Appleton said,
"You won't get away with it." "By it, you mean?"
Appleton did not try to be coy.
"I am talking about the bomb you have positioned somewhere high in that building right behind you. The one with the fuel rods from Trombay and the detonators from Switzerland. I'm guessing the RDX came from Algeria."
Khan shrugged.
"I'm impressed you know as much as you do. Why is it that my misdirections have fooled everyone but an old college professor? A former CIA station chief who couldn't even protect his greatest asset."
Appleton bristled now.
"People believe what they want to believe. Me? When I found out you were alive and working with B Company, I wanted to believe you were here planning new crimes. From there, it was simply a matter of hard work."
Khan nodded, impressed.
"You say I won't get away with it, but, Theodore, the difficult part is already achieved," Khan said. "It will be the easiest thing in the world to simply detonate the device. I won't wait for the wind to stop, but I will wait for the rain that should be here soon, and it will help contain the radiation to this section of the city. By my act, I will single-handedly carve out the financial heart of India."
He shrugged.
"Other than you and your friends, things could not be going more perfectly."
Appleton said,
"Why are you doing this?"
Khan nodded again, appreciative of the question.
"Palak Bari has been my benefactor for over a decade.
we share a mutual hatred of the Hindus, a mutual hatred of the government in power here. It transcends all the other differences between us. I was slipped into India 1 year ago, along with other men I've recruited back home, with this mission in mind. He waved a hand around him. I've barely left this flat in all that time. With an added shrug, he said, I've barely left this office. And B Company? The local gangsters did what I asked because Bari told them to.
Appleton raised an eyebrow.
The local gangsters don't know what your plan is, do they?
To this, Khan smiled.
The leader of the cell does. He's been promised riches in Pakistan when this is all over. The other men in the gang helping me? They don't know, and they won't know until it's too late for them to do anything about it.
Appleton nodded, looked at the floor a moment. The wind thrashed against the glass of the floor-to-ceiling windows. Finally, the American said,
Tell me. Tell you?
After biting his lip, Appleton said,
Tell me what you did to her.
Appleton did not say Emil Vaziri's name, but he didn't have to. Murad Khan understood what the American was asking of him. The Kashmiri shrugged.
I liked Emil. She was talented, professional, not terribly intellectual, but she did her job. When I started the Kashmiri Resistance Front, I knew I could use my position in the ISI to lead people off the track of me and my plans. Someone in my office got a tip from the military about Major Mufti being a part of the organization, and I tried to keep a lid on this within the ISI, but somehow the Americans found out. That's when I knew we had a leak. From then on, it was simple counterintelligence, made more complicated by the fact that I was holding two jobs at the same time. I would leak a little information to different members of our staff in Islamabad, then wait and see if the Americans reacted. It was a few months before I homed in on Emil. She was a liaison with the executive offices, not a member of the Foreign Coordination Unit itself. I didn't know for sure until I told her, and her alone, that we'd picked up chatter about Major Mufti's visit to the base in Peshawar. When the CIA sent a strike force in parachutes right on top of the place I'd indicated to Emil, I knew she was the one.
Appleton swallowed hard, but he did not speak. He only waited.
After that, it was only disinformation that I passed her. If you ever harbored apprehensions that I tripled her, that she was actually working for me against you, let me allay you of those concerns. She was your agent. You used her.
He shrugged.
I used her. And then?
Appleton's voice cracked when he asked. Khan shrugged.
After Lahore, you should have pulled her from the field. You should have gotten her far away from me and the ISI.
The American's face showed so much anger that two of the Pakistani security men moved closer, lest he try to attack Khan with his hands tied behind him. But he did not attack, and Khan continued.
I had her kidnapped from her apartment. I had her killed.
He raised his hands to the former CIA man.
What else could I do?
Through tears, Ted Appleton said,
Piece of shit! I believe in my cause, Theodore. More than you believe in anything in the world, I swear that to you. I believed in it then, and I believe in it now.
He stood and motioned out the window towards the second tower.
My plan here is the culmination of my life's work. Even when I targeted America, it was to get them out of the region, to stop their support for Pakistan so I could have the ISI resources and the freedom to target India.
Appleton's eyes misted over.
I don't believe you. I think your mission 12 years ago was sanctioned by the ISI, just as your mission now is sanctioned by Palak Bari.
Khan smiled, but did not answer. Appleton sniffed, then gave an exaggerated shrug.
You can tell me, because obviously you are about to kill me.
Khan looked out to the ever-darkening sky, then back up to the retired American spy.
Yes, I am going to kill you.
Again, he raised his hands.
What else can I do? But no, you don't get the answer to all life's mysteries as a consolation prize for your failure to stop me today.
Appleton brought his shoulders back.
I told the police.
Khan just shook his head.
You told Raja at RNAW, and Raja told B Company, and B Company told me. If you had notified the police, B Company would tell me that. They have not. So that means you did not. I also told...
Khan shook his head.
Just stop, Theodore. Keep some shred of your dignity intact until the end. When I die, whenever that may be, that is what I will do. You failed 12 years ago, and you got your agent killed. You have failed here, and you have gotten another one of your agents killed. What are you talking about? I don't have agents.
Priyanka Bhandari was led into the study. She was not bound, but Nasser Rasool walked close to her, ready to grab her if she made trouble. Appleton could not hide the expression of shock and pain on his face. Priya, however, kept her head up, her eyes strong and fixed on the face of Murad Khan. When she was pushed up next to Appleton, she said,
"You killed my uncle."
Khan held his hands up to her face.
"With these very same hands."
She lunged at him. Gone was the panicked girl who'd trembled and wept under his stare. She was made of fury now, and he was the focus of all of it. Nasser Rasool recoiled in surprise. She slipped away from him before he could grab her, but Khan just smiled as she got within inches before the men watching over Appleton yanked her back. Khan motioned for her to be shoved down onto the sofa. Appleton was still on her right, and Khan stood above them both. To Priyanka, he said,
"I needed your uncle to tell me who hired him. He did, and by catching Theodore here, I have also caught you."
He smiled.
"I can only assume you were here to assist the American assassin, who is lurking somewhere close by."
Priya shrugged.
"I was here to identify your location, and the location of the bomb, and then to notify the police."
Rasool said,
"I prevented this. She did not call the authorities. I checked the phone at her terminal and her mobile."
Satisfied, Khan said,
"My only question to both of you now is, where is this American assassin?"
Rasool's phone buzzed in his pocket. He turned away quickly to answer the call. With wide eyes, he looked up to Murad Khan.
"It's Jay. B Company can't get in touch with one of their perimeter team next door. It might just be the wind, or some technical problem, but..."
Khan looked startled.
"He's here. We have to go over there."
Rasool shook his head.
"We have 4 of our best men protecting the device."
"And that American over there has killed 12 men so far."
Khan stood.
"We are all moving to the device. We'll wait for the rain over there."
One of the security men said,
"What about these 2? Should I kill them?"
Khan looked at them both.
"No, they are coming with us. Appleton employs Mr. Cobalt, and this woman, she has some influence on him as well. He's risked his life to save her already. We might be able to draw him out by getting him to try again."
Rasool said,
"He might already be inside the construction site."
Khan had begun moving to the door.
"We have 6 security with us. You and I are both armed. If he is there, and if the B Company men on the ground floor don't stop him from getting upstairs, then we will. We can take the elevator directly to the 33rd floor.
He added,
"We will protect the device until we use the device."
To this, Rasool said,
"We can't use it till the rain comes. That could be another 2 or 3 hours."
Khan didn't answer this directly. Instead, he shouted at the American man and the Indian woman as the entire entourage headed to the elevator bank.
"If your American continues to interfere, then I will blow the damn bomb and all of us up with it. To hell with the fallout. He will be responsible for the death of millions."
61. 12 years ago. The 6 men of Gulf Sierra ran around the side of the warehouse where they could then get eyes on the western side of the bunker. When they made their turn, guns high, they saw a huge mound of dirt the size of a couple of city blocks surrounded by concrete. The fight was to the south, around the corner ahead, but Court saw movement coming out a side door, just 40 yards or so in front of him. He'd barely had time to register the 3-man RPG team when Sierra 2 opened fire, shooting the Grenadier at 50 yards. Gentry and Pace also began shooting, dropping the 2 riflemen who had been accompanying the Grenadier. And then the men heard it. In a slight lull in the battle, the roar of a dual-rotor helicopter straining for altitude passed over them. Looking up, they saw the red and white Chesapeake Hilo rise over the bunker, then bank hard to the left and dive back towards the deck. The Gulf Sierra men opened fire on it, but only for an instant before it disappeared on the far side of the massive building, heading due east.
"One away,"
Lennox said, frustration in his voice. The SEAL came over the radio again.
"There's another Hilo coming out! We're engaging!"
Court reloaded his magazine as he continued to move, then clicked his transmit button.
"You want to access the bunker from that door, one?"
Zack said.
"Negative. We stay outside the bunker. We've got God knows how many friendlies firing into that building. I don't want to walk into that."
"Copy,"
Court said, and he continued running forward, closing on the battle from the northwest. The gunfire had picked up again by the time Gulf Sierra arrived at the side and took a position behind a low blast wall that jutted from the hill that covered the bunker, and the sound of another helicopter flying away could be heard on the other side of the wall. They couldn't see this Hilo from their vantage point, and it must have been flying without its lights, because there was no glow in the sky above them. Zack got back on the radio, raised the captain of the Ranger platoon now, and told them his location. The young captain allowed that he'd lost a dozen men, killed and wounded, and was with the SEALs and engaging from positions behind the hangars on the far side of the airfield from the bunker, some 300 yards from the now open blast doors. The captain said,
"Be advised, there is a Pack Army Huey spinning at idle outside a smaller door to the bunker. It's about 75 feet from the other side of the wall you're behind. The aircraft appears empty. Do we destroy it?"
Zack said,
"Negative. Do not fire in this direction. We'll knock it out so that no squirters fly away."
The Ranger said,
"Copy. Oh, shit. There's a third Hilo in the haze."
The six men of Gulf Sierra came out from around the wall now. They saw the flashes of gunfire over several acres of concrete and smoldering grasses in front of them, men hidden behind vehicles, burning piles of tires, discarded equipment of all kinds. The Bell 412 was less than 100 feet away, alongside a smaller garage-style door that was open to the bunker. The massive blast doors, also wide open now, were just beyond it. As Zack and his team watched, a third red and white dual-rotor helicopter flew out of the darkened bunker with surprising speed, its wheels just a meter or so over the ground, and it immediately banked hard to the left, away from their position, as it struggled to climb. By now, however, the SEALs and the Rangers were ready. Light machine guns from six different locations concentrated their fire on the aircraft. Sparks and fires flickered from the lumbering beast when it was less than 100 feet in the air. The red and white helicopter dipped back down, as had the others, but the withering fire had eviscerated the control surfaces and the hydraulics, and soon the big helicopter went nose down, heading straight for the flat earth to the southeast of the bunker. Court watched from several hundred yards away, but he knew there was likely a radioactive bomb on board, and he told himself there was nowhere he could hide to minimize the fallout. He just stood there, next to the wall, watching the unreal spectacle before him. Kendrick Lennox, however, had not been stunned into passivity. He grabbed the drag handle on Court's body armor and yanked him back around the wall and onto his ass, just as a shuddering explosion rocked the entire battleground, knocking everyone else to the ground as well. Flames shot high into the air, and smoke boiled from the wreckage. The six men climbed back to their feet and regarded the scene. The new fire burning 400 yards away gave an ethereal glow to the entire area, and bodies lay everywhere. It appeared the crash had killed many of the KRF fighters trying to defend the launch of the helicopters. Hightower quipped quietly, almost to himself.
"Guess we all got nutsack cancer now."
But Lennox said,
"That wasn't tons of ANFO going up, so I don't think the dirty bomb went off. The plan must have been to wire the detonator while in the air to avoid an accident on the ground."
And then, without warning, yet a fourth helicopter screamed out of the darkened bunker, its own wheels no more than a meter off the tarmac. It flew directly through the fire and smoke there, moving more than twice as fast as the previous Chinooks. Machine guns opened up in the direction of the Hilo, but it banked hard, the pilot clearly a master at moving his aircraft in ways that seemed to defy physics, and in seconds it disappeared over the eastern wall, lost in the darkness. Hightower said,
"Son of a bitch! Three of those bastards got away."
Then he turned his attention to the smaller helicopter spinning nearby, and he reached into a pouch to retrieve a hand grenade.
"I'm fragging this, Huey."
He pulled out the baseball-sized hand grenade, and Jim Pace did the same next to him. Court didn't have a hand grenade, so he aimed in on the right side of a distant KRF fighter crouched behind a burning pickup truck. He fired a few rounds. The man dropped. Then Court quickly lowered his rifle and looked to the helicopter ahead on his right. Its main rotor and vertical tail rotor spun, but the lights were off inside and it appeared to be empty. Hightower and Pace were about to pull the pins on their frag grenades. Court said,
"Wait!"
Hightower turned to him. Angrily, he shouted,
"What?
If our comms are out, does that mean the Reaper feed to the talk is dead as well?"
Zack thought quickly.
"If somebody is jamming the satellites, then the Reapers could be blind."
He looked up. In addition to the clouds, the smoke from all the fires had blackened the sky.
"Even if they were back online, they sure as shit didn't see those helos take off. Why?"
Court took a deep breath before he spoke.
"Zack, don't blow the Huey. Get the team into the cabin and strap in tight."
"What the fuck are you talking about?"
"We're going after those helicopters."
Redis turned around and looked at the younger man.
"Who's gonna fucking fly us, dumbass?"
"Me."
Court didn't wait for anyone to say anything else. He just broke across open ground, running as fast as he could for the Bell helicopter. In his headset, he heard Zack transmit, though all of the Gulf Sierra men were close together now.
"Everybody board that Huey!"
Court was less than halfway to the helicopter when the co-pilot's door opened and a man in a Pakistani Army flight suit appeared, raising a pistol in Court's direction. Court's rifle had been aimed towards the garage doors to cover his run from anyone lurking there, but he dove for the ground and rolled onto his right shoulder as the pistol cracked. He came up in a combat crouch, pressed the trigger of his rifle twice in impossibly quick succession, and the co-pilot slammed back against the fuselage of the helicopter, then slid down to the concrete and onto his face. Court arrived at the aircraft, shot the fallen pilot again in the back, and then kicked his pistol away, and while doing so, he heard Hightower on the radio trying to raise the other American forces present.
"Dodger, Ranger, Lima Foxtrot, this is Gulf Sierra Actual. Be advised, Gulf Sierra is taking the Pakistani Air Corps Huey and going in pursuit of the three Chesapeake transport ships at this time. Do not fucking shoot at us. How copy?"
To Court's relief, just as he climbed into the co-pilot seat, both the Rangers and the SEALs rogered up, while still engaging KRF fighters in sandbag positions in front of the bunker. Someone on Lima Foxtrot rogered as well, though it wasn't Foxtrot 1. Zack ran around the front of the 412 and climbed into the seat next to Court.
"You sure about this?"
Court wouldn't have considered this a course of action if the helo had been sitting there still and dark, but the fact that it was running at idle rotor RPM now told him the aircraft was ready to take to the air, and he wouldn't have to fire it up from a cold start and wait for the oil and hydraulics to reach the right temperature, a process that could take 10 minutes or more, if he even knew how to make it happen. He'd never flown the Bell 412, could only guess at the startup procedures based on the helicopters he had flown, and he most assuredly hadn't mentioned this to Sierra 1 yet. But, he told himself, he'd get to it eventually. Right now, he was only thinking about the third helicopter that took off, catching up to it, and putting his team in position to shoot it down with their rifles. Hightower called again over the radio to the SEALs and Rangers. They were several hundred meters away and had had a better view of the fleeing Boeing Vertals.
"Anybody see where they went?"
"Affirmative,"
replied the Ranger captain.
"The first departed to the east but then banked around to the northwest, flying low. The second helo followed the same course as the first, about 30 seconds behind it. The third that got away, I didn't see. He was lower, faster. I think he went north."
Camp Chapman and Camp Salerno were due west. If the armed helicopters were heading to the northwest, they were likely going after Bagram or Jalalabad. Court opened the throttle and pulled back on the collective, and the Huey went light on its skids, then rose into the air. He pressed on the left foot pedal, countering the main rotor's torque, but he severely overcorrected and turned the aircraft hard to the left. He lightened up the touch on his left foot. The 412 rotated back around to the east on its axis, and he continued pulling back on the collective as he held the cyclic in his right hand. When he was only 20 or 30 feet in the air, he pushed the cyclic forward, tilting the rotor disc above him, and he began moving forward as he continued to climb. Despite assurances from the men on the radio, Court have expected some 19-year-old Ranger or some hot-shit SEAL with a squad automatic weapon to rake fire at his little helicopter, but he climbed into the thick smoke without getting shot at by either the good guys or the bad. They banked over the wreckage of the downed Boeing Vertel, increasing speed, and Court struggled to manage the helicopter's simple but stiff controls. In the back, the men flew with both doors locked open. They were strapped in, and Cort could communicate with the men without using the helicopter intercom system because everyone was still up on the team radios. Just as they entered the thick soup of low clouds, however, Zack leaned close to him and shouted into his ear without hitting the transmit button.
What's the plan?
Cort joked as he picked up more and more speed, staying just below the low cloud cover. He answered over the whine of the engine and the thump of the blades above.
The plan? I was supposed to have a plan? Seriously? If I can get us to within rifle range, then there's a chance we can shoot them down. That's as far as I've gotten with a strategy. Good enough. How long till we're in range?
Cort looked around at the panels and gauges in front of him. There was a simple radar, which he thought he'd have no trouble operating, and a radar altimeter along with an HTAWS, a sophisticated helicopter terrain awareness and warning system that might, if he could figure out the damn thing, help keep him from crashing into a mountainside. On the radar he saw three blips. One flew due north, towards Peshawar, not even in the direction of Afghanistan. The second and third, however, were farther away, and they seemed to be heading in the general direction of the U.S. military base at Jalalabad, just a 30-minute flight from here, over the mountain range separating Pakistan from Afghanistan. Bagram was in the same direction, well past Jabad, so he couldn't rule out that one or both of them might be headed there. It occurred to Cort that the Americans over the border in Afghanistan wouldn't be able to see the inbound helicopters on radar yet, due to the mountains themselves obstructing any radar echo of aircraft flying this low. He ignored the lone flight heading north towards Peshawar. It didn't seem to be a threat to American forces, and instead, he oriented his helicopter to go after the two heading to Afghanistan. Hightower repeated himself, again leaning close and shouting in his ear.
How long till we catch them, Six?
Cort concentrated on his controls and instruments because he could still see nothing outside the windshield. He decided now was the time to come clean.
I've got to be honest about something, boss. Shit, here it comes. I don't know anything about the operating ceiling of a Huey or the weight limits. It's very aircraft specific, and I'm not trained on it. The air is going to be thin going over those mountains, and I don't know if I'll be able to make it over the top of the range. Can you catch them before the mountains? Maybe. Our speed isn't that fast, but those big Chinooks are going to be carrying a lot of weight.
Cort looked back over his shoulder at the four men there, two on each side of the helo, strapped in with their legs hanging out the doors.
I'm carrying some weight myself.
He just shrugged.
This was kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing. No idea if this shit's gonna work.
Zack flipped up his NODs, then reloaded his rifle in the tight confines of the pilot's seat.
Well, kid, I like your style, and we're gonna give it a try. We've got to stop them, or at least get line of sight on somewhere with a coalition radio so we can report the Chesapeake transports as hostile.
Cort said.
Roger that.
Zack added.
Maybe avoid mentioning to the guys that you don't know what the fuck you're doing right now. Yeah, that'll be our secret.
Zack nodded his head, and the PVS-24s slipped back over his eyes.
Don't you fucking crash us, Six. Copy.
Cort looked ahead and saw nothing but clouds pressed tight to his windscreen, but he nevertheless increased to full power. 62. Present day. Priyanka Bhandari moved through the lobby of Tower 1 surrounded by men, guns, and what she felt to be an intense, almost evil energy. Appleton was in front of her, and they had not spoken. She hadn't seen the point, and he had a look of despondency and defeat that meant he wasn't about to start chatting with her. She stepped outside, again in the center of the entourage, and was immediately slammed in the face by the high winds. The air was wet, though the driveway was covered, and the rain had not yet begun to fall, and the only thing keeping her from tipping over was the men pressed tight up against her as they ushered her into the back of one of the three big SUVs. Khan and Rasool climbed into the same vehicle as Priya, along with a driver and security man, and Appleton was shoved into the SUV behind them with four more men. The rest of the Pakistani gunmen took the last vehicle, and the motorcade immediately raced off, out from under the covered entrance and into the incredible wind, for the 60-second drive next door. Priya felt gales buffet the vehicle. She watched the driver struggle to negotiate this, as well as a heavy mist from the nearby bay that hit the windshield faster than his wipers could clear it. Khan turned to her from the front seat, though he almost seemed lost in thought. He said,
"My plan was to live.
I was going to have a helicopter pick me up after I initiated the detonation sequence.
He waved a hand around the car.
Then the monsoon. No helicopter. Still, managing setbacks has been a huge component of my profession.
He pulled an iPhone out of his pocket.
I have the weapon set with a 60-minute countdown timer. That was the plan.
He shrugged.
But with my phone, I can override that and detonate it immediately, any time I want. If we get your man, then the plan continues. We wait for the rain, I activate the bomb, and I leave. But if your man causes any more trouble for me, I'll just go down with the ship.
He smiled, genuinely, it seemed to Priya.
You'll go with me, of course. The damage to India. Just the same, if I live or die.
Priya said,
I heard you were adept at faking your death. I have no doubt you're still trying to find a way out of this for you personally, no matter what you say now.
She looked at Rasul, at the driver, at the other man in the back with her.
These men are as good as dead. More fools for you to use.
Khan looked to Rasul, sitting next to her.
Gag her.
She fought back as both the big security man and the smaller Pakistani struggled to get the veil off her head, which they then tied tightly in her mouth. They finally accomplished this just as the SUV skidded to a halt under the covered drive at Tower 2. The driver and the other security man climbed out and immediately drew pistols. They looked around a moment. Armed Pakistanis filed out of the other vehicles, and soon the all-clear was given. Khan and Rasul stepped out, while Priya and Appleton were led from their respective SUVs. Priya saw that Appleton had been gagged as well. All 10 entered through the glass front doors of the tower. Building materials, forklifts, generators, and other equipment were positioned and stacked all around the space. Easily 15 men were already present here in the poorly lit and still unfurnished lobby. These were B Company regulars, Priya knew instantly. She recognized a couple of them from Andari East, and she could also discern that they were extremely agitated. Che was here, the commander of the force supporting Khan, and he shouted into a radio, demanding an update from someone who did not reply. Rasul marched up to him.
What floor is the American on?
We don't know if he's in the building. Our guy in one of the tower cranes on the southwest side hasn't responded. We're sending 2 men up to the tower to check him out. Could be a radio issue.
He looked to Khan now.
You told us to stay at the perimeter, but we have enough men to search this entire.
Khan said,
You and your men remain on the ground floor or outside. My men are up there, and we are going up as well.
Jay looked at him with suspicion.
Why can't we, at least? If you have a problem, you know who you can call, and you know what he will say.
Priya thought Khan was talking about Palak Bari, and Jay immediately backed down, making her more confident she was right. She and the rest of the group from Tower 1 then walked to the center of the lobby, where a massive bank of 8 elevator shafts stood. 6 of the shafts seemed to be empty, but 2, to Priya's surprise, had cars in them but no doors. The building obviously had not been completed. There was no power, no lights, so she didn't understand how an elevator could be operational, but she was led into one of the cars along with Khan and several other men, and Appleton was put in next to her. The car began to rise. Again, there were no doors, so she could see each empty and darkened floor as they began heading up. Khan ignored Priya, but spoke to Appleton.
These are called jump lifts, elevator systems for high-rise construction. The motor is on the bottom, nothing is pulling it from the top, so you can use them while the building is going up. There are construction hoists on the outside of the building, but we don't want to be out there now with this wind.
Appleton did not respond, likely, Priya decided, because there was a piece of rope tied in his mouth. She realized both of them had been gagged so that they couldn't reveal any of Khan's plot to the B Company men here who, she figured, had no idea what was going on. They rose through the construction site, the wind howling on each open floor as they ascended. Court Gentry felt the wind catch under his raincoat, pulling it up on his shoulders. This gust must have been close to 50 miles per hour, and he held on with both hands to the metal, wet from ocean spray pelting him all the way up here from the bay behind him. It had been much slower going than he would have liked. Each step was an ordeal, and he'd not gotten far across the long arm of the jib before realizing his mistake. There was a narrow metal catwalk within the frame of the jib. He could move along it, one foot in front of the other while in a crouch, but if he'd taken his time in the operator's cabin, he might have found a harness and lanyard, and that would have been damn helpful right now. A long metal cable ran the length of the jib above the catwalk. It was used for workers to hook their safety lanyard onto if they needed to climb out. With the body harness all construction workers used working on high floors, the lanyard and cable would keep them safe from falling. But Cort didn't have any of that shit. He just hung on, struggled from one step to the next, and did his best not to slip on the wet metal bars. An even more powerful gust slammed into his back. He dropped down to his knees for perhaps the 10th time in the past 5 minutes, and as soon as it subsided, he pressed forward, faster now, trying to cover as much of the steel jib as possible before the next blast of wind from the ocean forced him to crouch and ride it out again. He knew he was not supposed to look down, but he did, again and again, hoping like hell to see the flashing lights of 100 cop cars making their way through the storm. But he saw nothing from his vantage point other than a desolate construction site, a long way down from where he held on precariously. He had 10 yards or so before reaching the end of the jib, the tip of which was moving just 10 feet or so above the roof of the building. The jib swiveled in the wind, back and forth, and he knew this meant that, when he finally did make it to the end, it would be over the roof of the unfinished building for only part of the time. He'd have to jump for the roof, timing it to where the jib hadn't turned too far to the north or south to where he'd simply fall to his death. He saw the trolley ahead, a big metal case on rollers that held the hook and pulley assembly and moved it backwards and forward along the bottom of the jib. It was 5 yards from the end of the crane itself, and he stuck his head out and looked down, again in vain, for anyone coming to his aid. Then, as he brought his head back in to walk the last few yards, he saw them, a pair of men in black raincoats standing there at the edge of the roof building. They, like Cort, were fighting the wind, adopting wide, uncomfortable stances, watching him with mouths agape. He knew in a heartbeat they were Pakistani henchmen of Murad Khan, and they'd likely been warned about the radio silence from the Indian pulling security in the tower crane, so they'd been sent to the roof to try to get eyes on the man in the distance. And instead, they found a crazy American in the foreground, 350 feet above the ground. The men had not lifted their weapons, but Cort saw squat subguns on their chests. Instead, they simply stood there, trying to keep from falling over, waiting for their target to come closer and jump down. The men didn't know Cort was unarmed, but they did know he wasn't going to pull a gun and start shooting from that position. If he let go to do so, he would certainly fly off the jib and down to his death. A new powerful gust caused Cort to crouch, and as he did so, he saw both men hold their hands up to protect their faces from the sea spray. He realized he had a few seconds to work with, though movement in the middle of a gust this powerful would have its drawbacks as well. He was at the trolley now, and he realized he might be able to make his way down to the hook itself and use the few feet of cable there to hang from, to swing back and forth until he could throw himself into the floor below. Quickly, Cort climbed out of the structure of the jib onto the edge, then climbed down the trolley to the hook block. The wind began to slow a little, so he dropped his head below the block, saw where the hook hung just 4 feet away, and then held on to the trolley with one hand while kicking his legs to swing him under the apparatus. The men didn't have a shot at him now. He was below them, 10 feet from the edge of the building itself. 354 feet above the ground, he let go of the trolley and sailed a couple of feet through the air, and as he dropped, he slammed both hands onto the hook itself, catching on the wet metal with his wet fingertips. The hook swung wildly. He was now blowing left and right with the swaying jib and back and forth under the cable holding the hook because of the momentum of his jump. Looking up at the roof one story above him, he saw the men moving to their left to get a shot at him. The jib he swung under came back around to the left just as he shifted away from the building, and now he saw two other men running his way on the darkened 33rd floor just below the roof. One fired around just as Cort swung forward with all the power he could muster, then let go of the hook as it reached the point closest to the building. He sailed through the air again. A 55-mile-per-hour gust helped push him forward as he dropped, and he landed on the roof one story below the gunman on 33. He collapsed his body to the unyielding concrete as he performed a shoulder roll to remove energy from his nearly 15-foot fall, and then he made it up to his knees. He was exhausted. His collision with the ground had not been one of his more successful moves, and his right hip and both knees hurt. But he forced himself to his feet, pulled his phone and his earpiece out of his raincoat, then flung the soaked garment to the ground, and this seemed to take a tiny fraction of the pressure of the wind off his back. He then went running in search of a way upstairs. He was unarmed, the enemy knew he was here, and two of them were just a single floor above him, surely coming his way. 63. 12 years ago, Omar Mufti set down his hulking Chinook helicopter in a field of saffron 10 minutes north of Ismail Zai. The side door was opened by one of the two armed men in the back, and then Murad Khan and Nasser Rasool leapt out into the purple blooms. Mufti took to the air again seconds later, then banked to the west-southwest and pushed his cyclic forward to tip his nose down. The two KRF fighters, each armed with a powerful PKM light machine gun, remained on board, strapped into benches next to the side doors, ready to open fire to suppress any resistance when they reached their target, forward operating base Salerno in Khost, Afghanistan. They'd been told the helicopter would fly to a very specific portion of the base before it detonated, and it would be their job to hold back any attack against them if the ruse failed at the last moment. Mufti climbed a little as he flew, but he kept his aircraft below 30 meters in altitude because he knew Pakistani air defense radar could pick up a signal if he ventured much higher. He would enter the Spingar Mountains soon, so he would be climbing then, but there he would be hidden from radar by flying through the mountain passes. He'd be above the clouds by then, and he'd have the benefit of the moon and stars to guide him, but for now he wore his night vision equipment and did his best to fly fast, to stay low, and to prepare himself mentally for his own martyrdom. Murad Khan and Nasser Rasool had mobile phones on them, but even though it was approaching 4 in the morning and they were far away from anyone who would be inclined to help them, they didn't use the devices. Instead, they walked through the darkness towards a single light on a lamppost in front of a farmhouse, perhaps 3 kilometers distant. Rasool warned Khan that their phones might be a compromise. Everything might be a compromise at this critical time in the mission. So they threw them into a swiftly moving stream on their way to the farmhouse, told themselves they would ask the farmer to take them in and drive them to Peshawar or some other developed area, and there the men would get new phones and a secure place to stay, along with some semblance of safety. It was a pity about Omar Mufti, Khan thought, as he trudged through the pungent-smelling saffron. It had not been the plan for the trusted former army major to die tonight, but by delivering a very powerful munition right on top of the American Special Forces base that had sent the men who attacked Ismail Zai, Omar would deal an excruciating blow to those who had disrupted the KRF's plans. And it was also a pity about the Camp Bostic flight. The American base over the border to the north would be spared because the helicopter he'd tasked to go there had crashed right after takeoff. But Khan told himself with his customary assuredness, Bagram, Jalalabad, and, to a lesser extent, Salerno would be forever changed by his actions tonight. America itself would be forever changed. And for that, he had every right to be proud. He put his hand on young Nasir's shoulder while they walked. With a tired sigh, he said,
You know, brother, I always thought this day would be the end. Now that I'm here, I wonder if it is just the beginning.
What do you mean?
25 of our brothers saw you and I climb aboard that doomed helicopter. Surely they won't all be killed tonight. Some will be taken prisoner, and through torture by the Americans, they will never say anything other than the truth. That we were aboard a helicopter that flew away before crashing in a fireball.
Nasir understood.
So, we are dead?
Khan smiled, still weary, still stunned by the evening's events.
And we should take advantage of this, don't you think? Hide away, bide our time for our next masterpiece. Use our cloaks of invisibility to our advantage.
Nasir nodded.
Where you go, sir, I will follow.
Then, Khan said, someday you will follow me to India. And what we do there to the Hindus will surpass what we do tonight to the Americans.
The two men walked on through the night, towards a light in the distance, towards their future. After 10 minutes of flying, the Huey piloted by Court Gentry was close enough to the first of two helicopters headed towards Afghanistan to where he strained to find it out his windscreen. Even with the night vision gear, however, there was so much terrain below them and clouds above them that he could not yet identify a massive Chinook. He chanced a glance down to the radar again.
We're coming up on it. Should be at our 1 o'clock, a couple miles.
Court was flying at 50 meters above the ground, low to be going this fast, especially with his lack of skill, but it occurred to him that the helicopter they were chasing might be even lower.
Look down on your side, he told Zack.
Zack himself peered through the windscreen on his side window.
Got it. Fucker's nap of the earth in it. Starboard side, 1 mile. Can this thing go any faster?
Negative. We're closing on it, though. Get the boys ready.
Zack spoke into his radio now.
Starboard side, 2 and 4. Time on target is about 1 mic.
Pace and Lennox were on the starboard side of the cabin, so as soon as they made it within range of the helicopter, two guns from Gulf Sierra would have line of sight on it. Court was as high as he could fly while remaining below the thick sheet of clouds, but every few seconds he ran into even lower wisps that obscured his vision. Finally, after coming out of a gray cloud bank at 25 meters, he could see the BV-107 in his NODs, less than half a mile away now. Lennox spoke over the intercom.
That first helo that went down didn't have its bomb prepped yet. The dudes in this helo have had 15 minutes to get it ready, so it's anybody's guess if we're going to catch the full Monty if we blow it out of the sky.
Hightower opened the window in the hatch next to him. Cold, wet clouds blew in at 165 knots as he pushed the suppressor and barrel of his rifle outside. He clicked the transmit button for his mic.
No factor. We take down that helo by any means necessary.
Court knew they were almost within range. His heading would keep them there, and his speed would eventually move them past the first aircraft, so he concentrated almost solely on his terrain radar now. They were still a few miles from where the fun would really begin, at the beginning of the mountain range, but he could see on the avionics that the ground below him was rising and falling more sharply every minute. The pilot of the enemy transport ship ahead and on his right, it was patently obvious, was far superior at controlling his aircraft than was Court. He flew 10 meters over the ground, rose and fell smoothly with the terrain below him, and did everything right. Court, on the other hand, was giving the five other men of Gulf Sierra the bounciest, jerkiest helicopter flight of their lives. It would be hard for them to aim accurately, but Court knew better than to fly much closer to the enemy helicopter, lest he crash into it or into the ground in the process. He'd try to carefully creep over to within 150 yards and trust the aim of the men jolting around like rag dolls in the back to shoot accurately. Zack broadcast into his radio now.
Shooters, go for the cockpit and the engines. If we take down the aircraft without the bomb detonating, then we might live to get a shot at the other one.
Less than a minute later, just after Court banked over to the BV-107, putting his aircraft about 175 yards off the enemy's port side, Zack gave the order to open fire. Lennox and Pace pressed their triggers on the starboard side of the Huey, making educated guesses about how far to lead their aim so that their rounds would hit their target. They each fired a magazine to no effect. It appeared like the other helicopter did not even realize it was under attack. The two men reloaded quickly. Redis and Morgan, strapped facing the other direction, turned their bodies around to try to get their own weapons on target, but it was impossible to do so without the potential hitting of the men on the starboard side. Court wasn't watching any of this. He was flying so low and so fast, he didn't take his eyes off his windscreen for a second, until Zack yelled,
"Break left!"
Court jacked the cyclic left. He had no idea why, but almost instantly he figured it out. Tracer rounds from a pair of light machine guns lit up the sky in front of his windscreen. The enemy helo was firing back, and they had better weapons for this battle.
And a better pilot, Court reminded himself.
All the men in the back of the Huey sloshed around with Court's intense and inexpert acrobatics. His helicopter flew only 10 meters above the ground before he leveled the rotors, and quickly the two men on the starboard side began firing frantically again, desperate to take out the machine guns on the helo, if not to knock the entire aircraft out of the sky. The enemy guns kept their fire up. Court climbed and banked and dove to try to make himself a hard target, but this had the effect of making accurate fire from his own aircraft virtually impossible. Lennox and Pace each dumped another magazine at the enemy. The pilot of the BV-107 climbed a little over the hilly treetops, and more machine gun tracer fire swept close to Court's aircraft, forcing him to bank away again. Lennox yelled from the back,
"Keep it steady, Six!"
Court's eyes danced quickly from his view out the windscreen, his altimeter, and the terrain radar, and he saw that the land rose sharply dead ahead of him, but the enemy helicopter was flying over a creek that would allow him to remain at a lower altitude. Court transmitted for the entire team now.
"Port side, get ready! You're up!"
He was telling Redis, Morgan, and Hightower that they would be engaging the helicopter, which made no sense to any of them since they were on the opposite side of the fight. But before they had a chance to ask for clarification, Court pulled the cyclic hard to the right, raised the collective for altitude, and began banking closer and closer to the enemy helo. Lennox and Pace emptied mags as they neared the enemy, but the flight was so erratic they were doing little more than waving their barrels in the general direction of the helicopter and pressing the trigger, hoping for dumb luck to end the threat. Court increased his bank to the north, and soon he'd shot behind the enemy helo, chased all the way by machine gun fire. He was above it now, maybe 30 meters higher, breaking in and out of the low clouds, and he continued banking until he found himself aft of the twin-rotored helo and its starboard side. He dove back for the deck, above the northern edge of the winding creek bed, and the dive increased his speed. Soon, Redis and Morgan entered the fight with their rifles just behind Hightower in the left seat, and Zack himself began firing a moment later. Court flew with his rotor just meters away from a hillside on his right, but he remained over the creek bed, less than 40 yards distant from the enemy at some points. The other helicopter's machine guns were quiet through this. Court didn't know if they were both reloading or if they were, instead, just repositioning inside the cabin to fire out the starboard side. But no matter the reason, he decided he needed to take advantage of this. He banked slightly to port, closed even more on the big helicopter, and the three Gulf Sierra shooters fired furiously. Kendrick Lennox, out of the fight now because he was on the starboard side, unhooked his retention strap and crawled across the belly of the cabin. He jabbed his gun between Morgan and Redis and opened fire just as they began reloading mags. Hightower saw what Lennox was doing.
"Kendrick, you're gonna get tossed out!"
Jim Pace reached back with a gloved hand and grabbed Lennox's pant leg, giving him a modicum of protection if Court had to pull the helo into another crazy banking maneuver. Court listened to the incredible amount of gunfire from the four operators, and he knew they were expending ammunition at a staggering rate. He was just about to tell them to try to conserve until he got even closer to the enemy, when machine gun fire again began pouring out of the cabin of the BV-107. Court reflexively banked away to the right, then realized what he was doing and stopped his turn, just as his rotor clipped a cluster of bushes on the hillside. He righted the craft, knew he couldn't bank right again or he would hit the hillside, and if he banked left, he would only close the distance between his ship and the enemy's guns. So he did the only thing he could do. He yanked back hard on the cyclic, jolting his aircraft slower and allowing the enemy to get in front of them. This took him out of the line of fire of the machine guns, but it also threw the four men in back hard against the rear bulkhead. His aircraft was 50 feet above the creek now and directly behind the BV-107, but he'd have to build up speed again to go after it. He'd just pushed the cyclic forward, however, when an intense light in his windscreen bled out his night vision equipment. He hurriedly pushed the PVS-24s high on his head and then looked at the spectacle in front of him. The enemy helicopter burned as it rolled across the rocky creek 300 yards off his nose. The sound of the explosion came just after. Court immediately began to climb, lest he fly through the fire and falling debris.
"What the hell just happened?"
Zack asked, stunned. Redis answered,
"I was aiming for the cockpit. Might have gotten lucky."
Next to him, Morgan said,
"Bullshit! I hit the rotor and he augured in."
Court was already picking up speed, banking away from the helicopter crash and looking for another enemy helo on his radar. He found it, some 5 miles ahead, and he brought his heading to an impact course. Hightower said,
"Don't look like an ANFO explosion."
He turned to Court.
"Can you catch another one?"
"Yeah,"
Court said.
"Do we have the ammo for another fight like that?"
Zack shook his head.
"Not like that. I'm down to 3 mags.
The other men chimed in that they were all down to less than half their ammo. Court raced to the west, heading for the helicopter still hellbent on making it into Afghanistan. 64. Present day. As he raced through the large, dark, empty, and open 32nd floor of Express Tower 2, Court Gentry wanted to call Priya to get any updates about what was going on, but he didn't dare take the time because he knew he needed one thing right now that was even more important than information. He needed a fucking gun. Men were coming for him, this he knew, and he also knew the only place he was going to find a gun was in the hands of one of the men who would, no doubt, try to use it on him. He ran to the southwestern corner of the building as fast as his feet would take him, towards a stairwell there. He assumed there was one at each of the four corners of the building, as well as a bank of shafts in the center of the room, though he was reasonably sure there would be no working elevators. Still, with four stairwells, there were four locations from which to descend, and he could only hope the men upstairs would split up before coming down to find him, not knowing where he'd go. He arrived at the corner, running light on his feet to listen as best he could for any sounds that might tip him off to danger. As he did so, he desperately looked around for something he could use as a weapon. The whipping wind blew plastic sheeting violently, maintaining its hold on 4-foot-high stacks of wallboard. Long lengths of rebar lay in rows, and construction workers' tool belts lay unattended in a pile, safe here from theft because the ground floor of the structure was held by gangsters. Court scanned the tool belts as he ran, ready to grab something to use against an armed man, but he gave up this endeavor and flattened his back to the wall next to the exit to the stairwell when he thought he heard rushed footfalls approaching through the noise. The tip of an Uzi Pro 9mm jutted out. Court could tell the man holding the gun was moving with care but also with speed, and when Court dove onto him from the side, the impact sent the man tumbling to his right. They were a dozen feet or so from the edge of the floor and the 350-foot drop, and the misty wind slammed both men's bodies as Court tackled the man onto and then over the 4-foot-high stack of wallboard. The Uzi remained in the man's clutches, but Court grabbed the gun hand's wrist with his own to keep the weapon out of his face. Court had been fortunate to reach the stairs before the man came out onto the floor, giving him the drop on him, but he had not been fortunate in his choice of enemy. This Pakistani was big, taller than Court, built to quickly shake off a bone-crunching side attack. He shook Court's hold off the gun, so Court launched off his powerful legs and closed the short distance between their bodies, knocking the man onto his back as he grabbed the wrist of the gun hand again. Still, the Pakistani held the Uzi firm. Court's enemy had one objective in life at present, to hold on to the gun so that he could shoot the American. Court, on the other hand, had two. He had to get control of the gun as well as prepare himself to deal with the inevitable arrival of more attackers. The two rolled around the near edge of the floor, neither able to land a strike because of Court's intense focus on the Pakistani's right hand and the Pakistani's desperate need to hang on to the weapon there. Together they made it back up to their knees, both working their way up to their feet to employ kicks. But the wind spun the men around suddenly. Court went for a headbutt and missed, and then they began to fall again, slipping on the mixture of sea spray and construction dust. Court swiveled on the way down and slammed his right shoulder into the man on his back as he hit the concrete, and this knocked the wind out of the Pakistani. Both men sent their free hand towards the Uzi, Court to confiscate it and the enemy to protect it. The Pakistani fired a burst of rounds, striking the ceiling, but Court knew to keep his body and his own hands away from the end of the little barrel. A pair of men in black raincoats appeared around the side of the stack of wallboard. They were armed with Uzis as well, and their guns were up, sweeping in Court's direction. The American rolled his body over the top of the Pakistani on his back, threw all his weight and energy onto the right arm of the man, and guided the Uzi in the man's hand towards the new threat. Simultaneously, he let go of the man's wrist and grabbed the gun with both hands, then shoved it forward with all his might. This caused the Pakistani's finger to catch on the trigger, and Court held the gun, adjusting aim, just as the two men attacking were about to fire on him. Court shot them both dead with a firearm that was not entirely in his possession. He slammed his head back into the man on the ground behind him, cracking his nose, then rolled farther onto the Uzi totally, and then off the man, his hands wrenching the gun away from the stunned and injured Pakistani. Court lay on his back, exhausted, as he turned the little weapon around, just as the man with the broken nose got his now free hand on a knife on his belt. Court shot him once in the forehead from 3 feet away. Still on his back, the American swung the Uzi around in all directions he could see, unsure if there were more attackers. Seeing nothing but the whipping sea spray blowing into the open floor, hearing nothing but the whistling of the wind and the ceaseless patter of blowing plastic tarp, he pushed himself up to a seated position, then climbed to his feet. He slung a fresh Uzi from one of the two new men's bodies around his neck, dropped the old Uzi and grabbed the weapon from the last man, taking off the sling and jutting the barrel and little foregrip into his pants at the small of his back. Armed with dual automatic weapons now, he started again for the stairs, but he stopped himself, turned, and looked back. He had an idea. Three dead bodies lay there, just 10 feet from the edge of the floor. He moved to them quickly and grabbed the first one by the ankles. 45 seconds later, he was back at the stairs, moving up, his weapon at eye level, scanning for a target. And as he did this, he tried to call Priya. She did not answer, and Kort took this as very bad news. Priyanka Bhandari, Ted Appleton, and 8 Pakistanis stepped out of the elevator shaft on the 33rd floor, into the high and howling winds whipping through the concrete structure. A single man stood there in a raincoat, an Uzi waving around in front of him and a radio held to his mouth. He looked concerned, and without so much as an explanation, this caused all of the 6 new security men to lift their guns to their shoulders and fan out. Priya and Appleton were pushed by Rasul over to a large orange freight container, its roof just a couple of feet short of the 12-foot ceilings on this floor. He pulled a knife and cut the gag off Appleton, then told the older American to untie the veil in the Indian girl's mouth. Rasul said, "We will need your voices to beg for your lives when we call your friend." While this was going on, Khan conferred with the lone man remaining on this floor. Priya understood the majority of the Urdu they spoke as he shouted to Rasul,
"3 more men not reporting. They went after that guy that came from one of the cranes, jumped, then landed on 32. I heard shots."
After a beat, he added,
"It's got to be the American."
Priya realized Cobalt was just a floor below them now, but she didn't know if this was good or bad. She'd assumed Khan wouldn't detonate the bomb prior to the heavy rains coming. He only needed to affect a few dozen city blocks and not the entirety of the city after all. But now that his weapon was clearly under threat by an enemy he couldn't get control of, he was talking as if he had no qualms about killing hundreds of thousands. She stole a glance to Appleton, who looked back at her, then towards the orange container just behind her.
"That's it."
"That's what?" Priya asked,
but before the American answered, she understood.
"Oh, that's it?"
She regarded the simple-looking container. It was several times larger than she'd expected the bomb to be, and it was terrifying to stand so close to it. Rasul spoke Urdu to the 7 security men on the floor, told them B Company had been ordered to stay on the ground floor, so it was up to them to kill this one lousy American operator who had designs on getting to and disabling the device. They each took a position behind a vertical column holding up the roof of the building, and they peered through the dim light, trying to discern any movement at all on this floor, which was difficult to do in the wind and the poor light. Khan noticed Priya staring in horror at the shipping container. He stepped over to her.
"The walls are lead-lined. The fuel rods inside won't be exposed until just before the bomb detonates, when the walls collapse out, exposing the radioactive material. I'd hoped to watch this happen on a camera feed on my phone while in the back of a luxury Eurocopter on my way to Karachi. But unfortunately, your friend's actions mean we might all be right here when I blow this city to hell."
As the security men began to fan out, Rasul answered a call on his mobile, then turned to Khan.
"It's Jay. He says he has body on the phone for you."
Khan rolled his eyes, then extended a hand.
"Fine. I'll talk to Brother Palak, perhaps for the last time."
He then shouted to his security officers as they moved from column to column, waving their submachine guns in the process.
"Find that American!"
Murad Khan took Rasul's phone, put the call on speaker, then spoke in Hindi to Palak Bari, the Indian-born Muslim and the head of B Company. Bari said,
"Jay says you're at the device now, and the storm is blowing hard." "Yes, the enemy is approaching."
"What enemy?"
"The old CIA man you told me about? I hear the authorities don't know a thing." "I have the CIA man. I have the girl working for him. I don't have their asset, the one they call Cobalt. He's in the building. He's killed 3 of my men 1 floor below us, and he is coming this way."
Bari paused a moment.
"What are you saying?" "I am saying we might need to activate the device early."
"In high winds?
With no rain? Are you mad? You'll kill 50,000 Muslims.
Khan's own estimate put the number much, much higher, but he didn't say this.
What else can I do? If we don't eliminate this American before it's too late, all our years of work will have been for nothing. I'll send all my men up there to find him. No,
Khan countered.
I don't want to see any B Company on the floor. They'll only interfere. The decision is made, Balak. My hand has been forced. I must detonate the device if the American gets any closer.
Bari said,
don't do it!
But Murad Khan ended the call, handing the phone back to Rasool. 65. 12 years ago. For the first time in almost 20 minutes of flying, Kort could see the moon and the stars. He'd come out above the clouds, not because he was so high above the ground, but rather because he was in the mountains now, and even though he was only flying 150 feet above the earth, he was over 10,000 feet above sea level. They were just 10 minutes away from the Afghanistan border, closing fast on the BV-107 that was carefully picking its way through the mountain passes, obviously to hide its radar signature. Kort looked down at his onboard radar to try and judge his distance, but he immediately noticed a new signature moving to the southwest of him. After watching the blip for a few seconds, he began to wonder if it was the same helicopter that had flown north out of Ismail Zai, as if it were going to Peshawar. That would have put it behind Kort, but if it had changed directions, he thought its speed might have put it about where he saw it on the radar, just entering the mountains heading to Afghanistan. He actuated his inter-team radio.
One, we've got a new problem.
Zack turned to him.
Tell me.
Kort pointed a gloved finger to the radar.
The guy who went north out of the base. It looks like he's turned and is heading towards the border now, south of us.
Shit, Zack said, looking at the blip on the screen.
He's heading to coast. Yeah, it's either Chapman or Salerno.
Hightower spoke confidently.
They'll go after Salerno. Much bigger target, more personnel, more to damage.
Kort thought this was probably correct, so he pushed any worry about Julie from his mind and asked,
which one are we going after? How long till we get eyes on the helo we're tracking now? A minute and a half, maybe two? If we take it down fast, can we head south and cut off the last helo before he gets to coast? We're northwest of him. We could set an intercept course to try to meet up with it at the top of the mountain range. It will be close, and the air will be thin.
Kort showed his indecision on his face.
I don't know if we have the power to fly that high,
Zack said.
Stay on current heading. We'll get the one we know we can reach. Worry about after. Roger that.
Kort knew Zack was making the smart decision, but if Kort had been in charge, he would have broken off his chase of the helo ahead of him and instead raced down to get to the one that was heading in the general direction of Julie. Still, he did as ordered and began looking through his windscreen to try to find the second helo. They had it in less than 2 minutes. Through his NODs, Kort looked ahead into a misty valley below him and caught the sparking of static electricity popping off the twin rotors of a helicopter. The pilot was clearly using skill instead of speed, doing his best to stay as low as possible, trying to hide in the mist. The valley rose quickly ahead of him, and Kort knew he'd be forced to climb through a series of snow-packed peaks before clearing Spingarh on his way to his target. His current heading would take him away from Jalalabad and towards Bagram, so Kort determined this guy was on his way to deliver a dirty bomb over the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Kort had his UE much higher, over the ledge that looked down into the valley, and he realized he would catch up with the enemy craft as it climbed up to his position to pick through the mountains. Kort transmitted on the inter-team radio.
Port side, you're up. Less than a minute,
Rita said.
Keep it smooth this time, Six. Tell you what,
Kort snapped back.
I can fly it smoothly into a mountainside, or I can go where the terrain takes me. Your call.
Zack said,
can it, both of you.
The engagement with the second BV-107 started very differently than the first. As Kort came up aft of the now climbing aircraft, he was surprised to see streams of tracers racing at impossible speed out of the lowered rear hatch, two fingertips of light trying to reach out and touch the Huey racing up from behind. Kort jolted the helo to the left and to the right, finding himself on the defensive from the beginning of the fight. he managed to fly to the north of a rocky outcropping that took him out of the enemy's line of fire for a moment, and he was thankful for this, because he saw the sparks and flashes as enemy machine gun rounds struck the top of the peak, tearing into the stone and sending it flying. Cort went lower and came out around the other side of the rock, so close his single blade rotor blew feet of loose snow from